for beginning experimentary class on Jewish history. So the first thing we have to do is acknowledge our limitations. Number one, you're limited to me. I'm the one giving the class. And I'm limited to what I know. And I'm limited to what I think I know and to my perceptions. So that's very limiting. And there are many, many midrashim and many, many sources, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. One of the challenges as we analyze Jewish history is discerning between when Chazal meant that something literally happened, and when did Chazal mean to tell us a message, and not necessarily that something literally happened. And the same question can be posed about the Torah. And this is a question that was written in one vein in the Talmud, but more explicitly written approximately 1,700 years ago. We have a letter to Rav Sadia Gaon, where they asked him, how do you know when the Torah means something literally and when the Torah means something figuratively? If we look at the Ten Commandments, how do you know if that actually happened the way it's written? And so he goes through the whole formula of how we know when the Torah is talking literally and when not. So the first place we have to analyze this is in creation. If we're going to start Jewish history, so then the place to start is in creation. So you read creation, and it says there was Adam and Eve. And you open the Midrashim, and you hear about other people. Wow! Adam had another wife. Wow! So you read the Midrashim, and you say, wait a second, what's going on here? You read the Mishnah in Sanhedrin. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin makes a point of telling you that Adam and Eve were the starting point, and God wanted the world starting from specifically one man and one woman, so there would be a unifying factor in the world. So that seems to be the direction to go. But then you read that Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel, and doesn't tell you where they got their wives from. So who were Cain and Abel's wives? So here you have to draw on tradition. Our tradition is that they had a bunch of daughters. And you see throughout Tanakh that girls are not mentioned too often. We have a tradition that the patriarchs had daughters that are not mentioned in the Tanakh. And this goes back to what we discussed earlier tonight, and that is that the Torah is not coming to be a history book. What we're doing is we're having a class in history drawing from sources when, in fact, those sources weren't written for their historical content. The Torah, the prophets, the Midrashim, the Talmud, whatever sources we're going to draw upon, were not written with that intent. They were written for other purposes, for the messages they had to convey. They were not written as a record of Jewish history. So we're having a class where we're really using sources that are complicated to use. Again, because we have that question of when did they say it literally? When did they say it figuratively? And this is a question that we should be aware of going back to the book of Proverbs. It says in Mishlei, it says in Proverbs, that there are things that are said and they're not meant literally. And one of the wisdoms that one has to acquire when studying Torah is to know when something is an allegory, when something is not to be taken literally. Lavin mashal umlitza. And this is one of the first concepts that Maimonides tackles in his Guide to the Perplexed. So this is one of our challenges, understanding what do we take literally and what not. And one of the challenges I have is in deciding which of the commentaries or which of the Midrashim to present, because you understand that Chazal have many different angles on how to view many things, almost everything in world history and in Jewish history. Let's take the simple example of creation. So you say, that's an excellent starting point. The world was created. But what are we going to do that our sages infer from a verse in Psalms that there's so much more to talk about pre-creation, before this world was created? And you have in the Medrash that there were experimental worlds prior to the creation of this world. and you see the description of in the beginning there was tohu vavohu. What does that mean? Say in the beginning there was vacuum, there was nothing but God. It doesn't say that. If I would have been writing the Torah, I would have written Bereshis, in the beginning there was God. Then God created. It's not what it says. Okay, but I would say the beginning is, God says, let there be light. God says, let there be... That's where I begin the Torah, but the Torah doesn't begin that way. And so we have a tradition that says there were worlds that preceded this world. And it is unclear among the sages whether there are remnants from those worlds, whether those worlds were abolished completely or those worlds remained. So one understanding among the sages is that some of the things you're going to find, like the fossil fuels, well, those are from previous worlds. Yes. So if the sages called it previous worlds, and we're going to call it something else, fine. But you understand they're talking to us about something we don't even know what they're talking about. They say there were rough drafts, there were trials and error, until finally this world, the way we know it, was created. And then they don't tell us more than that. So you look at that and you say, how do I stick that into history class? So I tell you what I know. I don't know what to say more than that. I can tell you that there's an essay written approximately 150 years ago by a rabbi who lived in Sfat that discusses that you can dig and you can find and you will find his name. He wrote the commentary Tiferes Yisrael. I forgot his name. He's the one who wrote the commentary on Mishnah, Tiferes Yisrael. Very pious Jew, he lived in Sfat. He'd wake up every morning, early in the morning, go to mikveh, daven neitz, and then learn the whole day with his talis and tefillin on. And he wrote halachic works, and he used to have correspondences with Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who's chief rabbi of Europe. So he wrote in one of his essays, he wrote that if you dig, you will find fossils from the previous worlds. When our sages told us that these worlds were destroyed, they did not mean there was no remnant left to the world, to those worlds that were destroyed. You understand that I don't know of an earlier source that understood our sages that way. He's the earliest one that I know of, little old me, again, I said, we're limited to me. He's the earliest one that I know of that actually says such a comment. He says, when the sages said that God created and destroyed worlds prior to this world, he left remnants from those worlds. And if you're going to dig, you'll find them. That's something he wrote. I could show you the essay. It's printed in the back of Mishnayot. People didn't like him for what he wrote, but okay. So that's one thing. If we're going to be discussing the beginning, we have to understand we don't understand the beginning. Because our sages tell us in many, many midrash, and this concept appears time and again, that the beginning you think is the beginning is not the beginning. Even in Pirkei Avot, even in the Mishnah, the sages discuss that there was a plan that predated the world, there was a Torah that predated the world, there was a concept of the Ten Commandments that predates the world. Why is any of that of importance? So Chazal gives an indication that time does not begin and the world does not begin where we think it does. Discussion in the Medrash, how many thousands of years or more than that, or whole worlds preceded our world. But the beginning that we know, well, that's the beginning that the Torah wanted our perspective to be with this as the beginning. So we begin with Genesis, the description of creation in 7 days, and there too we run into a discussion, how do we view those 7 days of creation? So Nachmanides illustrates that the 7 days of creation were actually 7 days of evolvement in sophistication. Nachmanides shows how the description of the Torah, the description is a description of evolvement of sophistication, and everyone is familiar with Rashi's interpretation that every day of creation consisted of 24 hours, but that's not necessarily what other commentaries would say. Meaning when you speak about creation, so, okay. For example, you have a Midrash that discusses Adam and Eve. It breaks down their lives into hours, breaks down their first day into hours, and the number of things they accomplished in an hour is beyond what we can fathom. So it seems a little bit far-fetched And so the commentaries have a discussion whether the term hour, day, year in the beginning of the book of Genesis, the book of Bereishis, have the same meaning as hour or day or year in the rest of the Torah. That's a discussion going back at least 1,000 years, this discussion. Meaning before scientists came along and said, the world is this many years old, you have a discussion already among the sages how to interpret the verses in the beginning of Genesis. And this, okay, again, if you want sources here, you open up the Seder Adoros by Rabbi Halperin, and he goes through the different sources over here, the different opinions. When the Torah says people lived 700, 800, 900 years, is that to be taken literally? And if it is, so then there are those that say the Torah points them out because they were the exception, because the average person did not live that long. Then again, you have Midrashim that say that the earlier generations were healthier, that because of Adam's sin, so death came down to the world, but it took time. Then you have commentaries that say that until Noah's generation, we were forbidden to eat meat. And so long as we didn't eat meat, so long as we were vegetarians, we had longevity. It was only after the flood, either because the earth was tilted on its axis, pre-flood, according to some commentaries, the earth all over was like the equator, 12-hour days, 12-hour nights. You see, the verse says, from now on, you're going to have summer, winter. The verse describes it that way. You don't have to understand the verse that way, but some say that's what happened then. So then, pre-flood, the world was different. The climate was different, and our diet was different, and so people had greater longevity. It's only post-flood that you find people living till 80, 90, 100, 120 years old. Pre-flood, people are living much longer lives. And another Medrash says that the reason they were granted such longevity was so that they could master nature. God says man is new to the planet. How's he going to understand the astronomy? If he doesn't follow year after year after year and keep records, he's never going to master astronomy. How's he going to master medicine? How's he going to master the plants? How's he going to know where to grow what? Well, it takes time and experimentation and following the course of nature to learn. So one Medrash says that that's why the earlier generations were granted far greater longevity than we find later. Yes, Uli?
Oh, well, when it says 24 hours, it doesn't mean 24 hours, it means millions of years. And so when
Wait, the Torah doesn't say 24 hours.
It says a day.
It says ve'erev ve'evoker. Now, erev and boker weren't yet created. Or and choshech were created. So the question is how you interpret that. Right. And you do have a verse that says ke'elef shanim be'necha ki'yom etmol. You do have a verse that says that in God's time, 1,000 years is a day.
But you can be in a dark cave and a 24-hour period can still last. I don't find the whole thing that says, oh, there was no sun and no moon, that the Torah, and if the Torah said that, like, there would have to be a reference in, like, saying what appears to be a day and really meaning, you know, thousands of years. Like,
but firstly, it's not an apologetic interpretation. It's an interpretation that predates all this research. So don't view it as they came up with questions from dinosaurs, so the rabbi said it. It predates them by over 1,000 years. Some of the commentaries we're discussing now are from 2,500 years ago. So I'm saying it's not, I'm just, forget dinosaurs for a minute. When you read Bereishis, just be aware that there is this discussion and it's not necessarily as clear-cut as we might be accustomed to thinking. That's all I'm saying. You want to say evolution or not? Okay, so Nachmanides had no issue saying that creation was an order of evolution. Fine. You want to say there were worlds that preceded this one, which the Talmud says and the Midrash says, and you have many sources, say it that way. You want to say nothing, everything started with the 6 days of creation, you could say that way too. And that's another point which we have to explore. The Talmud tells us in Tractate Rosh Hashanah that just as man was created, not a baby, not a suckling, man did not start off as a baby. Man started off as a 20 or 30 or 40 year old young man, a healthy, fit young man, Adam and Eve. So too, or the Medrash doesn't really compare it, I'm saying so too. The Medrash says, all of creation was created mature. meaning animal. Oh, chicken came before the egg, right? A mature chicken came before the egg. But if you're going to say God created mature chickens, mature animals, mature human, mature earth, meaning earth wasn't created brand new earth, but rather earth was created as a mature earth that would have fossil fuels and other things within the earth. What?
Never thought of it that way. That's what I think earlier, like people say evolution, well, how do you explain this? That would have taken years to form. And that's also like around what teacher in Khan Hyde said in terms of science, like, you know, there are explanations that, you know, look, you know, like you said, Adam was created like a man, and that if you put it before a scientist, you said, here lies before you, a 32-year-old man, you know, become an adult. You're like, ah, but you said yes, but like, what, are you crazy? Are you insane? He's 32 years old. So like these canyons and these mountains are teaching, who knows how many years before, was created that way. You know, and I sometimes I feel that like people are, you know, making like excuses, like you said, apologetic about like sort of thing like, oh yeah, well here's how we'll explain this verse to bring it, you know, to evolution, since we have a problem explaining ourselves.
Supposedly that's the same thing as some people take issue in the Israeli school system, I heard, that they said that, like, you know, that, like, they tried to prove the Torah's validity through the guise of science, which, okay, like, you know, like science, like, the way I see it, science is true because the Torah is true,
right.
You know, but whereas they're, you know, they're trying to be apologetic, you know, use that word, I think it fits very well. By saying, like, oh, this Torah is true because science is true. You know what I mean? And that's wrong. Like, no, like, we have
science is true because Torah is true.
That's what I believe. But then, you know, the education system sometimes told me is that they're trying to make it, they're trying to justify the Torah through the guise of science, which is a problem because, like, we have to, like, Torah has to be justified by us through the guise of anyone else.
Well,
you
know, very sadly, there's an author, very famous scientist, very brilliant man. He wrote a book called God's Illusion, and he used
what?
Christian Wilkins. Right.
What's it called?
God's Illusion. And he wrote, you know, in his book, the evolution in the argument, you know, in his argument, that the evolution is a way for, it's becoming a way for people to believe that, you know, there's no guys. You know, some evolutionists coming on saying, like, well, how do we explain how the Big Bang got to be there? What was there before? How did it just happen? Some people suggest it's aliens rather than suggest there is a God, you know?
Yeah, but none of that's new, you know what I mean? Like, there's always going to be a way because it's a much harder thing. Like, facing truth is always harder than, like, turning away from truth, you know what I mean? It's so much easier to be like, alright, you know what, I'm an atheist now, so I'm nothing but, like, a mammal slightly more intelligent than a dolphin. Or whatever. And so therefore, you know, like, you know, let me invent a gun and go on a rampage because none of it matters anymore. Like, you know what I mean?
Right, like, if there's no God, like, what's to stop me from doing all the, you know, stuff I want in this world? And, hey, I don't have to pay.
Exactly, but then where they're wrong, and in my opinion, kind of idiotic in that sense, is that, you know what, like, whether we like it or not, all we have is a degree of morality. Like, even if I decided one day, like, you know what, I don't believe in God anymore, God forbid, then I'm just gonna, you know, get a gun and go on a rampage because none of it matters and I can do whatever I feel like.
What,
you know, like I have the morality. I have something saying, like, no, like, I'm not gonna do that. And people who are atheists, they have morality. Like,
yeah,
they're like, they're not gonna go
robbing
and murdering. I mean, at least not all of them. Some of them will. Hopefully they'll come that knowing them will. It's cognitive dissonance, you know? They make these excuses so that they don't have to believe in God, you know? And the same thing, Jewish people are guilty of this also, not just in terms of God, but also ditching our, like, culture in order to, like, you know, in order to assimilate.
Well, I'll tell you something. I rely on my ability in God in the afterlife for the thing, because there's no way you can look at this world as it is and as it appears to be and say, this is it.
What do you mean, this is it?
It's very cool. Look at Dominic. Look at Hitler even. Sure, he died young. Sure, his empire fell, but he had a great time right up until the last minute.
I mean, he rose to power. He had a whole army at his fingertips, and you know, he died in the bunker when he wanted to.
I don't think it's 7 days. Time, are you kidding me? I think he was miserable at every single moment. Do you think any politician? Do you think that there's any politician in the world who is happy doing what they do? I don't think there's a chance.
No.
You see what like Bernie? You think Barack Obama? You think the smile he puts on is real? No, it's a show. It's an act. It's all pressure, and money is the root of all of the evil in that case. 100%. 100%. Only people.
I'm saying, look, there's people like Stalin who apparently get away with evil, because did he really pay for what he did? No.
But Stalin?
Did Hitler really pay for what he did?
It depends. Who are we to decide? Who are we to decide what the punishment is? You have no idea. You, for all we know, for every single second, like, you know, Paro. Paro had to deal with the 10 plagues, and believe me, those 10 plagues were awful. We can't even imagine how awful the 10 plagues are. The hell that came down probably came down at the speed of machine guns. It was ridiculous, you know? And therefore, but God said, God made his heart hard after every single one of them. He probably wanted to be like, you know what, just get these Jews out of here already. And then he came to the last one, at the 10th one, where he literally found Moshe in the middle of the night, to get your people out of here. And then God hardens his heart again after that, and they made them chase over. They don't have the choice. When you're in politics, you surrender your free will. That's the thing.
I think there's a midrash even that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Moshe talked to God, even Moshe, you know, he says, like, look, I don't get the world. I don't get the way it operates. Why are bad things happening to good people and good things happening to bad people? Rav Kirkendall, I think, told a story to us about how, you know, Hashem showed it, the exact scenario happening, and then, you know, but like, my point is that, you know, Hashem has an afterlife. People get rewarded who need to be rewarded, who need to get punished, who need to get punished. But in the next world, because we look at this world, good people die young, a lot of godless die young. You look like what happened to Rashi, you're like, what's that all about? You know? Like, what's that all about? And I rely on my belief in the afterlife to be sane. Believe that we evolved from nothingness, and we came from animals, and we're going to die and cease to exist in 100 years from now. Who's going to remember who I am? Rewriting? Who's going to remember him in 100 years from now? You know? Do you care like who your grandfather was like 100 years ago?
I wish I knew my grandfather was 100 years ago, however long until I don't know anymore. 100%, I wish I knew. Same, I wish. I pray that my descendants, God willing, I have them, will know who I am. You know, and who will know who came before me as well. But thank God, you know. But that's exactly the point, and that we're both trying to make, is that it's not just some spectrum of existence that just, you know, that we're just going with the flow. It's all for a purpose. It's all designed in exactly this fashion. You know, it's so obvious. You know what I mean? It should be, at least. But I think to anyone, it's possible to be so as obvious as it is. But we have the choice to look at it with the attitude, the goggles, you know, to make it not obvious, because then it justifies us acting ways that we know we're not supposed to act.
Brother, you're right.
I want us to end because we're short on time. There's one point I want us to revisit from your conversation. You said science is true because the Torah is true. I think we have to revisit that. There's a letter Maimonides' son wrote about that exact question, about how do you view science? And I think we have to discern a little bit between the different sciences and see what Maimonides' son has to say. If you remind me, then we could learn the letter inside in 2 weeks from now, and if not, I could summarize it for you. But it's important, because he doesn't exactly say what I understood you guys to be saying.
This is
Maimonides' son. Maimonides had a son, Rabbi Avram Hanogid. Rabbi Avram, he was appointed as he had a position in the court of the king, so he was called Hanagid, like the I don't know if you'd call it the ruler, because he was the one who was actually deciding on affairs there. And he wrote a letter about how to understand things that Chazal say and how to understand Torah and science, and I think we have to discuss that. But right now we have to go to sleep, so we have klach for tomorrow's tiyum.